When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Níor chuil a mise ceol ba dhuine na tuair gaibhne in éadan tine. A cheap ór de féin a láimh gach duine, agus éad a teacht anuas buile ar bhuile.
I made Trinity music. That's an, and the Amble talk, I'd never tell him to stop. I'd make the Amble make him stop.
Could you do it there now? Now, John, could you just tell us what you were doing there exactly?
Well, he's making music. Yeah. No, we're drawing out a piece of iron. The horse will go a bit close on one side, so we're tinning him right out on one side. And it's 1/4 by 1/2 iron, so it takes a bit of sledging to draw it out.
I'm Martin Cushion, and I'm a West Limerick man. So when I came back here to Mochra's house, which is about 6 or 7 or 8 years ago, I cut down the old craftwork that we were used to long ago. That was welding on the fire and all that class. So we had no welder at the time. Now we have got a welder, all right. But I do a lot of stuff in the fire yet, as was done in the old days. So the smith of the old days were looked up to as... Well, they were looked up to by the people. They were the only men in the vicinity of the for the parish, and they were looked up to, and they were to make all those stuff for the farmers and for the farmers' wives, mending pots and putting hand in kettle, and great favourite with the housewife.
My name is Ben Ryder, and how I come to do this job, I worked for a farmer in my young days. And he had 12 cows to milk night and morning, Sunday, Monday, Christmas Day, every day. And all the other lads had jobs that they were Saturday and Sunday off, or half-day Saturday and Sunday. And I thought, this is no life for me, so that's how I come to start at, way back in 1938. And I'm here ever since. Powers got owned at that time, but we had it rented. And then Powers got sold out his property, and he sold all those houses in the village, board and all included, out to whoever had them rent it. That's how I come to own the board, yeah.
What do you want?
Full set, please.
Full set?
Yeah.
This is the old bellows. They're still using...
Still the old bellows, yes.
What age is that now?
The bellows? Oh, I suppose it's about 25 years of age, that bellows, yeah. Purely. Very scarce now, those two. Very hard to get them.
Well, could you tell us what you're doing now, Ben?
Going to fit the shoes on the horse. Heating to fit them.
You have to get a good heat up first.
Get a good heat. Level them into the feet. There's two types of shoeing. There's hot. This is what we call hot shoeing. Cold shoeing is what you do. You go to the yards and do it out in the yards and that. This is what we call hot shoeing.
The hot shoeing is more effective, is it?
The hot shoeing is more effective, yeah.
Basically, the difference between shoeing now and shoeing, say, 50 years ago is that now the farrier travels to the horse and cold shoes the horse, or applies the shoe in a cold condition to the foot of the horse, whereas many years ago it was the normal way of shoeing was hot shoeing, whereby the horse came to the farrier's shop and was hot shod, or the shoe literally burnt onto the foot before being nailed on. This ensured a perfect fit, and the shoe of course was made to suit the foot rather than the other way round. Cold shoeing at the present time, as is properly done, can be every bit as effective, providing it's done by a competent man. And I think the emphasis must be laid on this to ensure that the man is competent when he's doing cold shoeing, as it requires a greater skill to get accuracy.
Well, of course, there's no very little making shoes now. You buy all your shoes ready-made. You mostly used to be, you had to make every one of them. Now you can go into the shop or into Ireland place and get them. No bother.
They're in different sizes.
All different sizes.
And you just fit them like
all
a shop.
Different weights. Different thickness.
You gotta watch the sparks there. And the red bits flying around.
He's not a small foot or he's not a big foot, he's just between. The size 4.5, as we call it, won't fit, and 5 is too big for him. That's why you have to cut the bit off. But you can buy the iron still, the bars, to make the shoes out of.
Make them yourself.
Well, you can
you
make
want
them
to.
Yourself, yeah. With those young fellas training now with the board and the grapple thing, they have to make them out of the bar.
It's good training, anyhow.
That's part of their training, making them.
Now, these are two apprentices working with you here, John.
That's
what exactly
right.
are they doing at the moment?
Well, John is here. They're making a pair of front shoes. One, John is making a pair of front shoes for a horse with a little bit of a problem. It's a horse with an avicular problem, which I suppose you may not understand, but it's a very serious thing with a horse. And Gerard is getting a pair of hind shoes ready for the horse. We're putting a stud hole in for a screw cock for show jumping. The horse is coming up for the show. And as you can see now, John is tickling up the heel of the shoe.
The vital important part.
Quite the important part of the thing.
You always have visitors coming in.
Oh,
too.
As you can see there, good morning. As you can see, being in Dublin, of course, it's a great place for passing. People pass, see the horses and hear the ambles and they come in and are curious. And of course, like a lucky horseshoe, as you
exactly.
can gather.
Yes. Well, what is it like actually working so close to the centre of the city, John?
Well, I think it's marvellous to think that we were able to survive in this modern time.
How have you survived?
Well, we've survived because we went out to the work. we went outside of Dublin looking for work. Dublin spread out over the 30 miles. We went as far as 30 miles back to shoe horses. Instead of the horse coming to the forge, we took the forge to the horse.
So the whole thing has changed in recent years?
Oh, it has changed in recent years. The work horse is gone and the hunting horses come in more powerful. The show jumpers, children's ponies, riding schools. It's all suburban trade, really. And these lads here are, as I said to you earlier on, that John is a third-year apprentice. That's this man
John
here.
McLaughlin.
John McLaughlin. He's a Dublin man. And he's a third generation of the family. It's his father and his grandfather and his great-grandfather. So John has decided to take it up.
Yeah. John, what do you hope to do later on now?
Well, at the moment, I want to get a bit more experience, you know. A few years. I'm just out of my time this year. And I just want to get a bit more experience with the mine, you know.
He has retained his father's old forge in Lucan, and he hopes in a couple of years' time to reopen it for himself.
Yeah. So there's a family tradition there.
It goes back a while, yeah.
And Jerry here is from the Moy in County Tyrone, my own part of the country. Jerry, what brought you along to Dublin to train?
Well, I was always interested in ironwork and horses, so the two of them go together. I'm born in Gapplewick, kind enough to take me on as an apprentice. So... it's all worked out so far.
And will you go back to the north then?
Yeah, I hope so.
Well, is there much work for a farrier in the north now?
At the minute there is a good bit. There's not so many farriers in the north.
My name is Brian Kavanagh. I'm employed by the Irish Horse Board, Bord na Gapall, as an assistant manager in control of the Farriery Apprenticeship Scheme. This farriery scheme has been in operation since 1971, and we indenture young men from around the country into the ancient craft of farriery. We train them in modern methods of the shoeing of horses and the making of horseshoes, and after a three-year apprenticeship we qualify them and register them with the board. During this apprenticeship they have intensive training courses under the board's direction and spend most of their times with many of the top class master farriers throughout the country, such men as Andy Mahon, Sonny Brennan, O'Connells of Bansha, Pat McDonough of Shrewl, and many other top farriers throughout the country.
My name is Andrew Mahon from Cushington Ashbourne, County Meath, and I am a farrier, shoe horses all over the country, and I travel. I'm one of the farriers that I think I do the most travel in Ireland. I travel about 1,000 miles a week, and I shoe every type of horses that you could name, from the workhorse, which there's very few of them now, and to the racehorse, to the yearlings, to the hunter, to the polo pony, to the show jumper, down to surgical shoeing on foals. But I'm trying to concentrate more now to get away from the racehorse and the hunter, and I'm going to try and concentrate more on surgical shoeing, which I think there's a great scope for now, and I'm interested this few years down it, but now I'm really going to get into it much more than I ever did.
What is this surgical shoeing, Andy?
It's a corrective shoeing. It's for a foal, when foals is born with crooked legs and the conformation is not right, this is something that it can be put right with the proper care, because our horse industry now is so valuable and animals are so expensive and the cost of producing these animals, that now when people, the buyer comes from the continent or from wherever, he will come from America or wherever, he wants the best, and everything must be perfect before he buys.
The training methods over the years have changed somewhat, and the length of apprenticeship has changed. In years gone by, apprenticeships were as long as 12 years, with many of the initial years spent on the hand bellows rather than actually shoeing. In that time, with general educational standards having risen and a more technological approach to training. It has been possible to lessen the period of apprenticeship, although some people still feel that it should be a little longer than it is. Other changes have taken place over the years is the famous itinerant farrier called the journeyman no longer exists. He was an interesting character in his day, travelling many, many miles, in fact travelling forge to forge all around the country, offering his services to blacksmiths and farriers on a day-to-day basis. And many fine gates and railings throughout the country were done by these journeymen.
And yet, in a way, you've come back again to the travelling farrier, haven't you?
Indeed, the travelling farrier now is a man who, highly mobile. One such man is Andy Mahon, who travels up to 1,000 miles a week in his car. In fact, I understand two cars on the road at the present time. Has a travelling forge and literally, as he claims himself, a supermarket of shoes, so that he has whatever shoes are necessary to do the job. So that one could say that, in a modern idiom, that the journeyman has returned.
I run at a business. I start at 8 o'clock in the morning and I finish, let's hope, at 6 o'clock in the evening. But there's many the time I'm called out at 8, 9 o'clock at night, maybe 10 o'clock at night, which I run it as a business, my son and myself. We go to wherever the work is. And we make our own shoes, a lot of our own shoes. We buy some of the machine-made shoes. And I always carry a stock of about 100 set of shoes with me. I have a mobile forge behind my car. And whatever we need, I have got it. You name it, I have it.
Lot of farrier work at all.
It's only a small
mostly,
part.
Other parts, only a small part of my is farrier work. Mostly farm machinery and things like that. And those steel points, roadworks and all this thing. You get plenty of that work.
Within a radius of a mile, mile and a half, I would safely say there was anything from 15 to 20 forges. But then we had the work, the men had the work here, every firm from here round, all the bakeries, all the people on the quays, all the carriers, undertakers, whatever you have, those horses, dairymen. So with the result, that was plenty of work. And
Could you just tell us, John, where the forges were here now?
Yes, of course I could. Well, this is Mackenzie's. There was two forges in Mackenzie's. There was one in Boland's Bakery, one in Johnston Murray O'Brien's, there was one in Ringsend, one in Shaw Street, one in Mark Street, one off Townsend Street, there was two in Peterson's Lane. Now, if you crossed the river then, you went to Foley Street, there was one in Foley Street, there was one in Marlborough Place, that's off Marlborough Street, there was one in Church Street, there was one in Hill Street, there was one off of Amiens Street. Back over to Mount Street here, there was two in Ladd Lane, there was one in Stevens's Lane, there was one in Parish Court. I mean, I could keep going on and on as far as I can remember, numerous forges in the City of Dublin. But the horses were in the City of Dublin then, at that time.
This is true, mainly because the population of horses has tended to centre naturally, I suppose, around the population of humans. So that with horses having become a leisure sport in recent years, naturally they have centred themselves, particularly in riding schools, in the areas of human population. This has given rise to farriers being in plenty supply in Dublin, Meath and Kildare areas where the majority of population tends to reside. However, in other country areas, a lot of gaps still are there for need of farriers, and to this end the board will be recruiting exclusively in country areas this year for apprentices.
When the war was over and tractors start coming on and the horses start dying out, the work horse start dying out, a terrible lot of forges closed down, and a lot of these men, they were all very handy type of men, and they went into welding and they went into making gates, and some of them went into the garage business. As many as the man in big business in garages, and if you went back on him, he'd tell you he'd done a term as a farrier. So this what happened, and a lot of forges closed down over a number of years, and just a few stuck on and got it going again.
How many would there have been now in this area, around this part of...
Well, when I was serving my time, I'd say there was about 10 farriers there. Now, there's only two at the moment. Well, I have my own son, and there's another man, he has two sons as well. But that's all the farriers that's in this locality. I know in County Meath is big and there's a lot more farriers out through, but not that many.
Are there many apprentices
yes.
to the farriery now?
There is a lot of apprentices. Bord na Gcapall has done a good job in encouraging these young lads. They have provided the money and gave them a start in life anyhow.
My name is Michael Bower, and
from where?
From Roscommon. I was born in Kessery, in County Roscommon. And there's two blacksmiths beside us, John Egan and Charlie Egan, and his father, an old man, Pat Egan. And I used to go in at the evening time and going from school blowing the bellies. So I was getting sort of fond of it, like. And this day John said to me, so would you like to learn the blacksmithing? I said I wouldn't mind. But I'll have to see my father and see what he'd say. And my father went down anyway a couple of days after. And he said, surely you can be going in there after school to you and doing something for you anyway. So he started to let me make egg soups and staples and a few things like that. So I was getting on very well at her. And he said, God, he said, I think you'll make a good smith, says he. I kept at it anyway, and still going to school. Next thing I started shoeing horses, pulling off shoes off, big heavy horses, pulling off shoes off of them. He wouldn't let me nail them on. So he said, God says, I think you'll be all right at this, says he. Says he, you'll have a trail on a young man. So I kept at it anyway, and I did it. When I come 14 and a half, I was leaving school. I admit I'd almost finished.
Well, of course, again, it's from Mick's time and my time and my father's time and Ireland's time. The board, the Gapel, a semi-state body, have given them a course, an apprentice course, and they do 6 weeks a year training. They do two 6 weeks comprised of about 3 weeks making shoes and different types of ironwork, surgical shoes, and then they do a lot of anatomy. They're expected in their exams to be able to dissect the foot and know the different ailments of a horse's foot and where they come from and how they're affected and one thing or another. Sorry, I'm out of wind at the moment after the heavy sledge. But yes, they have an excellent good training. I mean, the people from the veterinary college, professors and one thing or another, spend quite a long time with them, teaching them and showing them. And as I said, why, we never got that training. Mm. We didn't get to know too much about anatomy.
Well, has it made any difference, really?
Oh, of course it has made a difference. I mean, we were known as Billy the Blacksmith one time. Now these men are farriers. And they're handling very expensive stock, horses costing thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds. And the people now realise that it's a vital part they play. So they're paid for the work.
I'm Jack Furlong, and I'm 70... practically 76 years of age, and I've been a blacksmith and farrier for 61 years, and I served my time to my father, who worked up to the age of 76 years, and he in his time served his time to an uncle who established the business in the year 1881.
Were there many smiths in Bray in that time, Jack?
Oh, well, I couldn't talk about how many were there in the granduncle's time, but in my father's time there were six. And there were quite a number of horses. Of course, most of the transport was done by horses. All the farm work was done by horses and deliveries, all that kind of thing. And very few cars at the time. They were quite a novelty. So then the cars began to appear, and in time the horse trade began to disappear and be affected, and I suppose about 20 years transport by
horses had nearly disappeared. So then there was very little work. Times were very depressed. I'm speaking now about the 1920s, 30s, and that. Just the aftermath of our troubles here in civil war, and there was very little work of any kind. No building, no. Just a few horses to be shod, and just a very meagre kind of living. And then there were so many, it was very competitive. It was very hard to get any kind of a rewarding price for your labour. And my father, during those years, he got the idea of forming a local association of smiths to organise and to try to establish a rate of prices for shoeing horses, ponies, donkeys, you know, and draft horses. And so he organised these local men, and they got chatting and talking, and then they tried to fix a rate for their work.
I'd imagine that in your young day, Jack, the attitude as regards payment would be a sort of lax, would it be?
Oh, very lax and very unbusinesslike, I might say, because there was very seldom cash payments. You had to keep a kind of a book and prepare bills and go out and collect them. And sometimes you might be lucky, you might get paid. Other times you might have to go a few times to be paid. But there was a lot involved, you see, and everything was very, you know, disorganised in a sense that I think a good deal of the smiths that time weren't very good businessmen.
They were able to make everything, and they, of course, being associated with fire, well, there was an old suspicion following them, and people, the young lads would come to the forge and they'd see the bellies blowing, and they wouldn't come in, but they'd be having their eyes wide open looking in, and the idea of the forge blowing and the blacksmith turning red iron and all that, that was something that in the young people's mind, or the young fella, child, that they were associated with the devil.
Mm. And they were supposed to have certain supernatural powers, weren't they?
Yes, they were. They had, a lot of them had. You know, you had a lot of in the old days, I don't know whether you have heard of them, but you had a lot of old pishogues and things like that. And if there was some smiths that had power over, if who were doing pishogues than me, and the person that the pishogues were doing, would go to the blacksmith and tell him that tale, and he had a habit of the sock of a plough, of the old plough, redden the fire, and if it was handed down to me, he could say some words over it that would bring the person that was doing new harm with the pishogues to the forge. So, you know, that was he was held as the king of the castle, right enough. He was.
In the days back there, the farrier was rated as a vet. He was always asked to do veterinary work. I remember, I've seen it myself several times, that he'd have to dose horses and he would have to take warts of horses, and it was several things like that. He was quoted as a vet type, because there was very few horse vets that time. There were cattle vets, and there wasn't as many vets now that specialises in horse work and different items of it. But that time there was only the one or two vets that was interested in horses, and they always worked along with the blacksmith, and they tell him how to do this and that, and he was able to do it then. It was several cures, the farrier. There was some great men that did specialise in this, cures and things like that, and with ointments and all this type of stuff that they made up themselves for cure for ringworm and all this type of work.
Did your own father have anything like that?
He never went in for the ointments, but he always done the tough dosing horses and taking warts off horses, and I seen him doing it for he had some stuff, I don't know what it was, for ringworm. And he do the lampus, which is a swelling on the gums of a horse, and he used to take that away with a hot iron. It cruelly, but it was a success.
Would you say that the older generation were great craftsmen?
They were wonderful craftsmen. You'll never get men like those now, because no matter what they ever went to do, they always had to make their own tools for to do the job they were going to do. And when the job was finished, you'd think that it was after coming out of a mould.
And you were telling me there that your father had a special way of shoeing a wheel.
Yes, they had their own idea. They never used a ruler. They used to call it a thing called... The only way I can compare it is a wheel in the fork of a bicycle. They used to call it a traveller. And that's how they could measure the wheel, down to the last eighth of an inch.
There's many men still left around. One in particular, perhaps one of our top craftsmen in the country today, is a man called Pat McDonough from Shrule in County Galway. Pat, a very good friend of mine and of the board's, still to the present day makes all sorts of blacksmithing exercises in gates and railings, and craft shoeing jobs of surgical shoes made from all sorts of different types of metals. And the board have in fact displayed the surgical shoes that Pat McDonough has made at Dublin Horse Show.
In my days of walking as a farrier around, I should say, 1930s, and at that time practically the horse trade was very quiet, and very there was no future in it. I was rather old then to adapt to any other trade. I was about 22 or 23, and I wondered what I could do. So I got the idea then of making gates, and I knew nothing about making gates or what was involved or nothing like that. So I went to Dublin to attend the technical schools in Bolton Street, who then had classes in smith work, both general work and in the art iron work. And I was very fortunate in finding a man there, a wonderful one, the great craftsman the country had. He worked at that time for J.C. McLaughlin's, who were very high-class iron craft workers, and this was one of their top men. But what I would like to say is that the distinction of the work he taught me to do, you see, with a lot of what is produced nowadays, which is termed wrought iron work, and which I would, in my estimation, would just called bent iron work, spot welded, without any design or any merit whatever. And they're generally positioned in very high-class shop windows and well displayed and that, and described as wrought ironwork, which is a misnomer. Now, wrought ironwork is wrought. It is wrought by hand. It's hand-forged, and most of the work I do is also forge-welded, which is quite entirely different from using an electric welder. You can't get the same symmetry, you can't get the same flow or design with these electric welders. And you can just bend and just join, and you can see all the marks of the welding in that, unless they're ground off.
It's a sad thing as one drives around the country to see so many forges run down, disused, and that when one realises that they were the social centre of many rural areas throughout the country for many, many years. Unfortunately, these forges are little more than areas where the farriers make their shoes, although we do hope that in the future that we can entice some work back into the forge?
That was the one meeting place. That was from Saturday, or from Monday morning till Saturday, till late Saturday night. That was the social centre. They have their social centres now, but they'll never come up to the social centre that the forge used to be. Because I used to see maybe 10 or 15 old men there, and they'd be always in the way. They'd never be of any help to you. And bar when the haymen had come, they'd be standing around, and when the haymen go over to the pub for their bottle of stout, the old men had helped with the horse. That's the only bit of help they were. But otherwise, they were always in your way, and they were always telling stories and doing some villainy. But they were great entertainment, these old men.
I seen a fella coming into a forge one day and he had a bad toothache. And the blacksmith said to him, to see, I'll take that out, tooth out for you. So he got a bit of twine and he tied it around the tooth and he tied it to the anvil. And he blew the fires and all until he got the shoe real red. He popped the shoe out on the anvil and hit it a few taps of the hammer and the sparks flying around. The lad went back from the sparks, left the tooth hanging on the cord.
We had a missioner here one time, given a mission. He was from Mayo. Any devilman that ever started in the village originated in the forge. He says, I suppose this forge is the very same. So now you know what we are.
Going back to the peeling days and that, made the pikes and made the tools of war, you see, and they were very adaptable. And of course, their forges were the meeting places of the local historians and politicians, and everybody made the forge almost a club, you see. The day there were very few clubs those times, you see. In later days then, clubs were organised by the various friendly societies, the Foresters and the Hibernians and various other organisations. But up to those times, the forge was a great place for people going for a chat, you know, a great place for a joke or a hoax or a bit of fun.
I think that the farrier will always be there. The reason I say this is that over the years, particularly in America, they've spent many hundreds of thousands of pounds on research into all sorts of things like plastic shoes, stick-on shoes, and every conceivable type of shoe. And so far, to the present time, nothing but the handmade or machine-made iron shoe has been successful. And it will always require a craftsman and tradesman to nail the shoe onto the foot. It's an absolutely individual job done by individuals, and each foot is different to any other foot. It therefore follows that the farrier has a trade that can only go from strength to strength. As long as there are horses, there will be farriers.
You know, he's probably the oldest known craftsman, and I think he'll be still required at the end of time, because the smiths are still in use in big engineering industries, especially in shipbuilding. The smith has to shape the plates for the boats. That can't be done any other way, only by heating and having somebody to shape it to the desired templates. And boilermakers, which is also a branch of smith work, you see. So I think there'll be always a need for them.